in the United Church of Christ and the United Methodist Churches, of which we're affiliated with both in this church, we hold that science and this beautiful creation story, a myth, we hold them together. They are not antithetical to us. The creation story was conceived before the scientific method was defined. And despite not being science, it is still a really good attempt to understand the amazing thing called life that came into being 3.7 billion, let me get that order of magnitude right, 3.7 billion years ago. It describes to some degree or another that life started in simpler forms and became more complex over time. I invite you to read all of Genesis 1, if only because it is a story that includes sea monsters. Yes, God made sea monsters, and they were good. And it is a story that paints a picture of what people 3,000 years ago saw. That if one stands in one place and you look like this, you see the horizon 360 degrees around you. And it's as if we're in a snow globe looking at the dome above us. We can embrace the scientific explanation of the world and also appreciate this beautiful, intriguing myth. Notice in our story, after each of the 6 days of creation, we read, "And God saw that it was good." Good. While the church has sometimes dwelt in the theology of Augustine, that humans must acknowledge something he called original sin, there is actually no original sin taught in the Bible. Instead, what we find here is a theology of original blessing. I am guessing all of us have been in awe of nature on many occasions. And if we focus, notice, hone our awareness, we can be in awe of nature every day. Richard Rohr, who's a Catholic priest and thinker, writes, "Sin is not the primary thing that is true about us." Just take that in. Isn't that refreshing? Isn't that a beautiful thing? Sin is not the primary thing that's true about us. Before we are anything else, we are made in God's image. And we are made to reflect that image in the way we live. Before our scripture tells us anything else about ourselves, it tells us we are good. When we ground ourselves in the fact that God created us good, we are capable of confronting all the other things that are, in fact, true about us, even the very difficult things, challenges, how we use power inequitably, sensitivity and insensitivity, etc. The other single verse I read today, oh, I didn't read it, did I? It's from Romans. "Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep." The other verse I read today is about loss. We cannot experience being awestruck by life without feeling the pain of loss. We are not alone. In the Bible, we read about people honestly dealing with their pain and hurt and loss. They're wailing, they're crying, they're grieving. This is part of being human. In contrast, today, our society is both more individualistic and practice at succeeding, not losing. Sometimes we don't know how to express our loss, our sadness. Instead of grieving, we make what one book about grief calls an Academy Award recovery after loss, an Academy Award recovery, meaning we do not take time to experience the profound sadness of saying goodbye to a neighbor who moves, hearing our child's pain and receiving, maybe hearing harsh words from another child or a parent, or the death of a loved one, be they a person or one of our furry companions or scaled companions. So what is helpful in dealing with loss? Grieving begins with talking about our loss. We need friends, family, and companions with whom to share. And so my sermon today is a narrative about loss. I tried to save a baby bird when I was in grade school. In trying to feed it oatmeal through a little eyedropper out of a bowl of oatmeal, I accidentally dropped the baby bird in the bowl of oatmeal, only to try to wash it off, which was fatal. It's okay to laugh. Laughter is a companion to our loss, in many cases, to grief. The pain has lessened as I have told that story over time. 60 years later, in June of 2020, at the beginning of the pandemic, my daughter and I found a baby bird on the ground. I read online, "You should leave baby bird where it is and observe to see if mama comes to support it." But our maternal instinct kicked in, and we sprung into action, finding the right food for baby bird. The best foods recommended for baby birds online are both worms and soft cat food. And in our eagerness to support baby bird, we discovered something incredibly wonderful, that the absolutely best substitute for mama's beak was a baster needle that had never been used and was sitting in our kitchen drawer. Because it was strong and pointed and had a little flat place on the end where we could put cat food or impale a worm. The irony of feeding cat food to a bird, which might otherwise be considered cat food, was not lost on us. We read that baby birds can eat 12 inches of worms in a day. Luckily, worms were plentiful in our compost bin. We began feeding baby bird half worms and then whole worms. Baby bird was very vulnerable, and for any number of days, we protected it in the garage in a milk crate cage with a heating pad underneath some rags, which was also recommended online. During the day, my daughter started taking baby bird to the compost heap and elsewhere in the garden. Baby bird was gaining in size, puffing out its feathers. On day four, we realized that we might now have a pet robin. On day five, baby bird was hopping around more, inquisitive, and it made forays from the milk crate open to the world to the garden. Baby bird was eating so well, we worried that we were depleting the worm nursery in the compost heap at an alarming rate. Baby bird was now hopping from the wheelbarrow to my leg and into the grass. On day six, baby bird was at least an inch larger lengthwise from the day we found it. An inch, baby bird was growing. We switched from feeding with a basting needle to a tongue depressor, which required the baby bird pack forward and downward as it might have to do on its own to find worms. Once, baby bird saw a very small black bug on the edge of a bowl, watched it, and when the bug was right in front of it, it ate it. We were thrilled. The baby bird was learning quickly. I discovered on day seven of my notes about baby bird's progress, the baby bird acquired a female gender. This was simply our projection and not based on anything scientific. On day seven, baby bird took her first flight. Flight! She tried to fly and perch on a cable wire that was fastened closely to our house. She tried mightily to land on that vertical cable, flapping her wings for several seconds, trying to land on this impossible perch until she dropped down to the ground and did so somewhat ungracefully. Seemingly discouraged, again, another projection. She hopped and didn't try to fly for most of the rest of the day, at least when we were with her. But later in the day, baby bird flew from the compost bin to a dogwood, a good 20 feet. At dinner, we were all weighing in on whether to put baby bird in the cage for safety overnight. We were torn every day about whether we were creating more dependency on ourselves or succeeding at helping baby bird become independent. After dinner, we fed baby bird some cat food, and as she perched on the bird bath along with some worms by hand. We had been wondering all along how to diminish and then stop our hand feeding, which we worried would only reinforce dependency on us. Our after dinner playtime with baby bird involved her jumping on a short 2x4 that we had laying around. I put the board several feet in front of a wooden cucumber trellis, and sure enough, she flew to the trellis. And then, looking around inquisitively, she flew to our neighbor's garage roof. For the first time, out of our reach. Above the garage was a horizontal wire just 1.5 feet above the roof, and it was not taut. It was kind of like this, a swing. Baby bird jumped from the roof onto the wire. It appeared as if she was on a swing, rocking with the wire, wings nearly continually flapping to keep balance. This was not what she expected. So she wisely dropped down to the more secure garage roof. Baby bird started looking around again and flew another 20 feet to our garage roof. My heart was full and excited and joy-filled to see this bird engaging in just the thing birds excel at, the survival skill of flying. Dusk was upon us at 8:30. Dusk was upon us at 8:30, and baby bird set her eyes on yet another destination, the neighbor's tall white pine. Off she flew, out of our yard, to a branch, the farthest she had been from us in a week. She faced the forest preserve and perched for many minutes. We photographed and watched. We celebrated that she had chosen where to spend the night, and it was not in the cage. On day 8, baby bird was around the yard asking for more food. We couldn't not feed her, and so we continued trying new ways to help her find her own food, including dragging an apple core in the grass. More cat food, more worms. She would perch on the edge of the compost heap while her two moms were foraging for worms. My daughter found roly-poly bugs, and baby bird was able to snatch them from a little third of a coconut shell that was in the compost. She now was flying to familiar places in the yard, including the tops of our heads. It is really a quite lovely feeling to be a safe tree for a lovable bird. On day 9, baby bird appeared outside the bedroom window where my daughter was staying. We had a sense that she might actually have recognized her. Wow. Another day or two passed when we looked for baby bird in the morning and evening and couldn't find her. We were alternately hopeful and happy she was on her own and worried about whether she would find enough food on her own. On day 10, I was walking in the backyard and I found her body under the dogwood. Here, I brought tissues because it's hard for me to tell the story. Under the dogwood where she had first flown. We couldn't help but wonder if she had returned to the spot where she had eaten quite a few meals, to the tree in which she had first flown. We guessed that she might not yet have had the capacity to fully feed herself. There we go. I need it. But of course, that will remain a mystery. We will never know. I cried a very hard cry. Not like this. We had bonded with a baby bird who had eaten a lot from our basting needle in our hands, who had perched on the wheelbarrow as a mascot and flown to the dogwood, to our shoulders, to our heads, before venturing to the wires and the white pine. I picked up her beautiful body and buried her at the far end of our vegetable garden where she had first found a worm. Let's see. where she had first found a worm on her own, a still place for her eternal rest, forever connected to us and the life and the rest of the garden. Grieving is a basic human need. Sometimes it's about pure loss, emptiness, aloneness, sadness when a friend moves or a loved one dies. We also need to grieve hurt in relationships. When we are angry, blaming ourselves or another, we need to transform that anger so we might discover the deeper feelings of loss beneath the anger so that we can heal, so that we do not continue to be in pain, and so we do not transmit that pain to others. Most importantly, we love our animal friends, and when they die, we experience the heartbreak that's stitched into everything. So this summer preaching series from the end of June to next Sunday is based on a poem, and I've taken one line from that poem each week. And so the line from the poem this week is that heartbreak is stitched into everything. It's a beautiful phrase. It is a testament to creation. In Jewish, Christian, and Muslim faiths, we hold that while we can research and learn about creation, we must also acknowledge we will never master this beautiful mystery, something we can't fully know and can't contain. We attempt to give this mystery a name, the divine, the ground of our being, or God. We grieve because what we have lost is the connection we have experienced that is intimate love, love from and for our families, love from and for our animals, from and for, we have love from and for plants, trees, vistas, all of creation. I believe with theologian Andrew Root that the purpose of the church is to open us up to mystery and in the process to help us become more human, more able to love our own families, our neighbors, and the world. Of course, we must find a new way to love our creation before the sixth extinction is what we're in, a sixth great extinction, which is underway, changes our earth in a catastrophic way. We are making life in our home, planet Earth, impossible. The good news is that we do not have to take on these challenges alone. In the words of a great prayer written by Bishop Oscar Romero, we cannot do everything. And there's a sense of liberation in that, in realizing that. This enables us to do something and to do it very well. Let us know that heartbreak is truly stitched into everything. And together we can endure it, and together we can preserve the natural world so that others too can enjoy the privilege of life that always includes heartbreak, but is also full to the brim with joy. Amen.